What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Organic Guy Podcast. I am your host, the Organic Guy. This is your home of organic conversations where you get to hear from various thought leaders across the organic movement. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Mr. Ken Roseborough, who has written extensively about GM foods and non-GMO trends since 1999. He's the editor of our Organic and Non-GMO Report, a magazine that has become a go-to resource really for the organic and non-GMO movement. Ken's articles have appeared in publications and websites such as Civil Eats, Huffington Post, Yahoo News, among others. He is also the author of two books, The Organic Food Handbook and Genetically Altered Food and Your Health. So, Mr. Ken, before we get into the conversation, thank you very much for joining me in the podcast.
Happy to be here.
And I always like to get an overview of, you know, your early years when you are growing up. Was journalism something that you always wanted to do? Was, you know, your environment influenced by journalism, all that kind of stuff? So how did you get into the journalism space?
Well, I always enjoyed writing from a very young age. I just seemed to have a natural ability for writing also. I can remember when I was very young, when U.S. President John Kennedy was assassinated, I actually wrote an article, about that, you know, because I still have it somewhere, actually. So writing always was something I enjoyed doing, and it got me through school writing. I was able to write good papers, and but I didn't decide to write professionally until I was in my mid-30s. That's when I decided to pursue writing as a career. And I got a master's degree in professional writing and became a freelance writer, and then launched my Organic and Non-GMO Report in 2001.
Nice. So I'm trying to picture, we are in the early 2000s. What is the environment like in the organic and non-GMO space? I mean, what's happening in that space? And you go like, you know what, I think people need somewhere where they can go to get more information. What was happening in that period?
Well, the genetically engineered crops were just starting to appear, starting to be grown in the U.S. And there were people who were concerned about the health, human health, and environmental impacts of those GMO crops. So I was actually working for a lab that does GMO testing. And I was writing articles about their testing services for trade magazines. So the non-GMO market was very, its infant stages back then, actually. It just emerged as a response to the concerns around GMOs. So people started to want non-GMO. And that's when I decided to start the publication. I saw the non-GMO market kind of emerging and decided to launch a publication focused on non-GMO, because non-GMO was kind of an obscure term. It was used in the grain industry by companies that were selling non-GMO soybeans to Japan or Europe. So that's when I started it.
So it's interesting that you probably add a hinge that it would grow to this extent. You know, a lot of people nowadays are talking more about it. There's a lot of attention surrounding GMOs. So maybe even we go further, maybe there's someone who doesn't know what a GMO is. Maybe you can try and explain what is a GMO, and maybe if they don't know about it, why they should get to know about it.
Yeah, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. And what biotech companies like Monsanto, or now it's Bayer, they're genetically engineering food plants like corn and soybeans. They're taking genes from other species like bacteria or viruses and inserting those into the DNA of these plants, soybean or corn plants. In the case of soybeans, what Monsanto did, they took a bacteria and inserted it into the DNA of soybeans to make the soybeans able to withstand sprays of Monsanto's Roundup herbicide. So these plants were called Roundup Ready soybeans. That's the most common genetically modified plant that's being grown right now, herbicide tolerant GMO soybeans. And the other common GMO plant that's grown is it's called BT corn. What scientists did, they took genes from a bacterium and inserted them into the DNA of corn plants to make the corn plants withstand pests. So basically, they made the entire corn plant a pesticide. If a pest like a corn rootworm or something bites the chews on any part of the plant, it'll kill them. So you can imagine there could be some concerns about the corn from these BT corn plants that could raise concerns for human health.
Yeah, and I think Over the years, we've seen some research that has been done around this area. We've talked about this research, especially from Cerolini here in France. We did an experiment about GMOs, and those results were out. Obviously, as you would expect, were kind of dismissed from the GM industry. So this is how this is happening all these times. Can you maybe point out to an event or maybe a research that happened and you saw there was, you know, a steady rise of people wanting to see some interest, because you've been in this industry for such a long time? Is there an event you can point into and you say, you know what, when this thing happened, there was a huge concern of people wanting to know what GMO is?
Yeah, I would say you mentioned Cerolini's study. There have been other studies that have come out that have raised concerns about GMOs. There was a scientist in Great Britain that was doing some research on GMO potatoes, Arpad Pusztai. And he was actually working on these GMO potatoes, but he saw there were problems, that they could cause health problems. And he went on national TV and he was interviewed and he said, no, I would not eat these potatoes. So, and he published studies, and eventually he was fired from his position as a result of saying that. So that raised a lot of concerns. And I'd say in the U.S., the thing that really raised a lot of awareness about GMOs here was back around 2012. There were several states, including California, Oregon, and Washington, that organized campaigns to put a GMO labeling law on the ballot in those states for the election. Because in the U.S. at the time, we did not have mandatory GMO labeling. So there was a lot of organizing in these states, in California in 2012. And this raised a lot of awareness about the whole GMO issue among the U.S. population. There was a lot of coverage in the media about this. And I'd say that those labeling campaigns in those three states really brought the whole GMO issue to the forefront of public awareness in the U.S.
And maybe you would expect a lot of the mainstream media to take up some of these concerns that are being raised by the population of the United States and citizens of the United States, but that is not always the case. You know, some of the media outlets have been very much forward saying this is maybe the technology that we need to feed the world or to help the disadvantaged countries. So I haven't seen a lot of critical journalism towards this technology, especially from the mainstream media. You know, what has been your take on this? Why do you think mainstream media doesn't really want to take this direction of actually questioning, hey, is this technology safe? What is the science behind it? Can we help people get to understand more? Why do you think there's been this way around of not the mainstream media not reporting this kind of science?
Yeah, unfortunately, the mainstream media has repeated the biotechnologies industry's talking points that GMOs are going to feed the world, they're going to create more nutritious foods, they're going to reduce pesticides, all of which have not come true at all. So, and there's pressure, like particularly in the U.S., the biotech industry has a lot of influence, and any reporters that speak out about GMOs, they tend to be pressured by their editors. I think of a journalist who worked for Reuters News Service, Carrie Gillum, who wrote many articles about genetically modified crops and also glyphosate herbicide. And she was starting to cast a skeptical eye on these areas. And Monsanto contacted Reuters and basically told their editors, hey, she shouldn't be doing this. You know, it's not true. What she's saying isn't true. And they got her editor to pressure her to stop. And she eventually left Reuters and is now on her own and has written several books about the problems with glyphosate herbicide. So there's some of that going on too, that the biotech industry will put pressure on journalists and news services. And it's interesting, whenever there's studies published that show there's negative effects with genetically modified foods, the researchers who publish those studies are actually attacked by the biotech interests and viciously, you know, attacked about it, and their careers are threatened, and a lot of pressure is put on researchers as well as journalists who try to speak out about GMO risks. And there have been studies showing negative impacts, quite a few studies actually showing negative impacts of GMOs. But it's hard to get those studies published because the universities, like in the U.S., are basically working with the biotech industry. So they have no interest in making their corporate sponsors look bad by publishing research showing negative impacts. So the whole industry industry, the biotech industry, exerts a lot of influence on the media and the universities. So coming out with information showing negative impacts on GMOs is pretty rare in mainstream media.
I can imagine so as well. In your case, has there been like maybe an attack on your work on some of the articles that you've published on your website?
In fact, this past week, we posted something on Twitter about our website. We have a lot of good information showing negative impacts of GMOs. And immediately, there was a bunch of pro-GMO people that came in and commented and saying, you know, you're saying, oh, you're putting out false information, lies, you know, GMOs have been proven to be safe and all this other stuff. So that has happened. I mean, I haven't been threatened or anything like that, but it's mainly been on social media. That on our Facebook page or our Twitter feed I've gotten attacked by the pro-GMO people.
Interesting. And of course, through some of the work that activists have been doing since the 2012. So finally, it looks like the US has some kind of labeling for GMOs with the bioengineering label. And there has been a little bit of pushback. Maybe the label is not clear enough. Maybe the consumer will not be able to understand it, blah, blah, blah. But from your perspective, what can you tell us about this law? And do you have any concerns towards it?
Yeah, this labeling law, it is probably the weakest GMO labeling law in the world. It has huge loopholes. It allows companies, they have this bioengineered logo that companies can use. And it just from the start, bioengineering is not a familiar term to people. I mean, people have become familiar with GMO or genetic engineering, but to introduce this bioengineered term that nobody is familiar with, that's the problem right from the start. And the companies, they can use, instead of the bioengineered logo, they can use QR codes, quick response codes, those little boxes with the funny characters, they can use those. And, you know, you can imagine a mother in a grocery store with a child, you know, looking for food and grabbing something and pulling out her cell phone to read this QR, you know, and they actually, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which developed this law, did research and they found that consumers do not like QR codes, but they went ahead with it anyway. And so another labeling option, people can call an 800 number to find out. So this law allows food companies to continue hiding the fact that they're using GMO ingredients. Another real big problem is that any ingredient, like a refined ingredient like beet sugar, or oils like corn oil or soybean oil, if that's tested and there's no detectable DNA, then the product doesn't have to be labeled. So this immediate, and it could be derived from GMO corn oil or GMO soy. So that immediately exempts thousands of food products from labeling. So the whole law, I mean, there's, you can go on and on. It's the worst labeling law in the world, basically.
Definitely. And I'm sure from their part, I think it's just genius marketing or hiding the obvious from the public, you might say. And I think it's deliberately being done so that, you know, the consumer doesn't have to know on what it is. So from their perspective, I think they have done something great. But from a consumer perspective and someone who's concerned, what are the final implications of this technology? It doesn't serve the public any good at all.
Yeah, I mean, the labeling law came about because the state of Vermont passed their own labeling law. And food companies saw this and they thought, well, all these states in the U.S. are going to pass their own labeling laws. So they'll have this patchwork of labeling laws and the food companies will have to comply with all these different labeling laws. So they went to the U.S. Congress and said, hey, you got to do something about this. And so Congress, which was under pressure from the food industry, just came out with this extremely weak GMO labeling law.
Yeah. It's interesting. The other part is you also published the organic and non-GMO source book, which is one of the world's only directory of our suppliers of organic and non-GMO. We've also seen recently a lot of publications, especially from the New York Post and the New York Times, making a little bit of criticism on maybe some of the claims that the organic movement makes on some of their imports might not be organic. Can you read like at all what are consumers saying towards such a kind of publication that you think can have any effect really on the organic market overall?
Yeah, well, these articles, you mentioned a New York Times article about the organic cotton coming from India. A few years ago, the Washington Post published an article about grains, corn and soybeans that were claimed to be organic, that were coming from, I believe it was Turkey, that were actually conventional. So there are a lot of concerns about this because it's attractive for devious players to try to sell conventional grains as organic because they can earn a big premium. It's a huge concern. Fortunately, the organic industry is taking steps to address the fraud, and they're getting the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the National Organic Program, to do things to address this. There was a massive fraud case within the U.S. There was a man who was working with several farmers in the Midwest, U.S., that was selling conventional corn and soybeans as organic. He was actually caught and convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison for wire fraud for doing that. Hopefully that sends a message to other people who want to engage in this type of fraud that there are consequences. But they got away with it. He got away with it for 10 years. He sold $250,000 worth of corn and soybeans as organic when they were conventional. And I wrote about him back in 2007. Somebody told me about him. And so we were one of the first ones to raise concerns about this man. His name was Randy Constant. Incidentally, right after he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, he committed suicide, which was tragic. The whole fraud situation is a big concern. In a way, it's good that these articles are coming out so that people will have to take action to really eliminate this type of fraudulent activity. Because for the consumers, it makes them less confident in the organic label if they see there's fraud going on. So it hurts the organic industry. Fortunately, I would say that most organic farmers are doing a good job, and they're committed to growing organic and all the good environmental and health benefits that come with organic foods. I would say most of them are, 90+% 95% have integrity, and they're trying to uphold the organic label.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point that you make there. The vast majority of farmers are actually very, very honest, and they're very straightforward in their activities and what they do. And it's good that this kind of articles can come out and, point out some of the front-end people that are within the organic movement. But, our energy has also to go to saying, thank you very much for your work that you're doing, for most of them, actually. So it's something that maybe something like the New York Times cannot do, try and go out and, spotlight some of the amazing farmers that are doing. Maybe that one won't make a good headline for them or something like that.
Right.
But it's understandable. I'm glad that, some of the colleagues from the USDA are, taking out these concerns and trying to solve that kind of problems. I think that's the kind of mentality that, we have to work towards to try and restore the integrity of the organic movement. So that's great news, I guess.
The media goes for the sensational stories. There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. It's good to spotlight these farmers, and that's something that we're trying to do, trying to spotlight farmers who are doing it right. There's a company that was recently certified regenerative organic, and they're buying cotton directly from farmers, organic farmers in India, and making products for them. And so I'm planning to do a story about them. I've written several articles about companies that are sourcing organic grains directly from farmers to assure consumers that what they're getting is truly organic and regenerative organic, which is another level of assurance for consumers.
It's interesting. We've talked a little bit about organic farmers, and right now the U.S. market is at over 50 billion euros. There aren't so many organic farmers in the United States. Where does this discrepancy maybe lie? You have a lot of people who are willing to spend on organic, but you don't have a lot of, organic farmers who are willing to produce these products. Why do you think there's that discrepancy?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. One is there's not much government support for farmers to transition to organic. They don't get the financial support that the conventional farmers get. The amount of money that goes into organic research in the U.S. Department of Agriculture is just a tiny fraction of what goes to conventional farming research. And it's hard for farmers to transition because the whole system is set up for conventional farmers. It's for organic farmers to transition their land. It's a three-year process to do that. So for 3 years, they can't sell their crops as organic. They're in transition. So there's not so much support for that. And agribusiness in the U.S. is just geared towards conventional production. And again, agribusiness has a huge influence on the government. For organic farmers, it's really a challenge. For farmers that want to transition to organic, it's a challenge to do that because of the three-year transition, and it's hard for them to get financing to do that. And I look at what's happening in Europe. I mean, Europe has committed to 25% of their land to be organic by 2030, I believe.
Yeah.
The U.S. could do that too, but they need more government support. There are a lot of private initiatives that are helping farmers transition to organic. So the acreage, the amount of land that's organic in the U.S. is growing, but very slowly. So I would say it needs more government support to really grow more.
Yeah. I think we can see an example, as you said, here in Europe. From a political perspective, at least they have that goal, and they seem to have that arch, you know, to try and create a vision of where, you know, other farmers can look up to. You know, this is something that there's a political will to do it. Maybe it's something that I can position myself to do it. So government definitely does have a huge role to play in terms of increasing that acreage over organic in general. And the other thing is that we see a lot of push for GMOs for other countries. So for example, my country in Kenya, right now there's a huge push for BT cotton to be grown by farmers. And, you know, if we can tell from history, that doesn't always end well. In Kenya also, it looks like it's going to happen. Being as a person who has, you know, interacted with these farmers and who have been in this industry for a long time, what kind of advice do you think these farmers can get?
Well, yeah, I would be very leery about the biotech industry is trying to push their GMO products in a lot of countries. And, you know, there's a lot of sales involved. And the reality is that these crops are failing. The Roundup Ready soybeans that are being grown, huge amounts of Roundup are being sprayed in the U.S., 300 million pounds per year. Weeds are becoming resistant to Roundup. With the BT cotton, after a while, the insects become resistant to the BT cotton and BT corn. That has happened in the U.S. More insects are developing resistance to it. It works. It may work for a few years, but it's a short-sighted solution. I would encourage farmers to take a close look at this and to see what the problems down the line will be, which includes insect resistance. That has happened with BT cotton in India. And you mentioned the farmers that go into debt buying the expensive GMO seeds and the pesticides, and they have a crop failure and they commit suicide. More than a quarter of a million farmers in India have committed suicide because they're adopting a technology that's too expensive and that it doesn't work for very long. You know, I'd be very skeptical about adopting BT cotton in Kenya, the farmers really, to look past the sales pitch from the seed companies and to dig into the research to see that this technology will fail. It will fail. It's a short-sighted solution that makes a lot of money for the seed companies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's a reality. I mean, I like the way you put it, the fact that we have to look in the long term. We don't have to look at it from the short term perspective. From the short term, maybe it will do 1, 2, 3 seasons very well. But what happens after that when it becomes insect resistant, or maybe you start using more pesticides for a new farm? So, I mean, trying to look at it from a long term perspective can really, really help and get a hold of the facade that this sales pitch are going to be made to farmers. I think that's a very, very good point as well. In terms of the future now, we've seen some developments. Now, there's a lot of talk from consumers wanting to know more about it. The United States have some kind of label that farmers can maybe refer to. So when you look at in the long-term perspective, where do you see this GMO movement really going into?
I think the GMO movement is not going to last, basically, because, as I mentioned, the short-sightedness of it. In the U.S., the Roundup Ready herbicide tolerance system, GMO system, is failing. Weeds are becoming resistant. Now they're using an older, more toxic herbicide, dicamba, that has its own problems. And they're just putting farmers on a pesticide treadmill. basically. The BT system, as I mentioned, works for a few years, but then insects become resistant to it. So right now, I see a lot of farmers, even conventional farmers in the U.S., are adopting what are called regenerative agriculture practices to build soil health. There's a big focus on building soil health to create more nutritious foods and to sequester carbon. That's one of the big selling points of this regenerative agriculture trend, is that it's sequestering carbon, taking it out of the atmosphere to help mitigate climate change. And I'm finding that a lot of farmers who adopt these practices, like they grow cover crops to keep their ground covered all year to prevent soil erosion, or growing more diverse crop rotations and just instead of just corn and soybeans, they find that they're able to reduce their use of chemicals, of pesticides and herbicides. And they also, a lot of these farmers I talk to, they don't need the GMO seeds. They don't need Roundup Ready soybeans. They don't need BT cotton, because the practices they're using are able to minimize weed problems and pest problems. So that's the future of agriculture in the U.S. and the world. I think regenerative agriculture and also regenerative organic agriculture. In those trends, the GMOs don't have a place. So I think they'll just go by the wayside, as well as pesticides. I think it's at some point people will look back on this time when pesticides are being used and they'll be horrified. Why did they use poisons to grow food? So the future, I would say, looks bright for organic, regenerative organic and regenerative farming systems.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very interesting question to ask. Here in Europe, they also have a target of reducing pesticides by 50% by 2030. So yeah. I think you have a very good point there. Maybe there is no future in terms of growing food with poison. You mentioned two words there that I might want to get your perspective on. You mentioned about the regenerative movement. So how do you think these two movements are going to go forward in terms of from a regenerative perspective and an organic perspective? Is there a room for these two movements to work together, or do you think they are sort of going to grow parallel past each other?
Well, I think they can work together because they're literally finding common ground in the whole focus on soil health. Organic, there's a lot of focus on soil health, and regenerative organic focuses on soil health as well. With the regenerative movement, there's a lot of conventional farmers that are adopting these regenerative practices, minimizing soil disturbance, not much tilling or plowing of the soil. Where I think there's disagreement or, you know, divergences with organic and regenerative organic, there's no synthetic pesticides allowed at all, no herbicides. Whereas in regenerative farming, farmers are using herbicides to kill cover crops. So there is that type of divergence. But even farmers that are using, the conventional farmers, find that they're reducing the amount of herbicides that they need to use. And in fact, some farmers, I know several farmers who've adopted these regenerative practices, and they were able to reduce their chemical inputs to a degree that they just said, I might as well just go organic. That's what some farmers have done, because adopting these regenerative practices has allowed them to eliminate their chemical inputs. So the two movements are moving ahead, and I think, you know, there's room for both of them.
Especially now, it actually shows the power of farmers concentrating on building their soils and how important these practices are. So it's very, very interesting. I can't wait to see how the movement, you know, goes ahead from there. Thank you very much for being gracious, for, you know, spending your time with me here in the podcast and sharing your insights and some of the, you know, experience that you've gathered for such a long time working in this industry. So I wanted us to move into the rapid fire question. So this is a segment where I throw some quick questions to you, and then you just give me the quick answers. So the aim is really to get to understand and to know a little bit more about you that maybe didn't come out during the conversation. So sure. Are you ready to get started?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. The first question is, what is the first career you dreamt of having as a kid?
Sports writer. Sports writer. A sports journalist. Yeah.
If you had to eat one meal going forward, what meal would you eat?
Probably organic rice pudding.
The third question, who is your favorite historical figure?
I guess one comes to mind in the U.S. is George Washington, our first president.
The fourth question, what sport do you like to watch or participate in?
Well, I like baseball. American baseball. I enjoy that.
If you could have any animal in the world as a pet, what would it be and why?
Well, I really like tigers, but I don't know about having a tiger as a pet. But
yeah.
Maybe a kitten, maybe a cat, some kind of cat.
What is your favorite beverage? Is it coffee or tea?
Tea, chai. Chai, actually, I like chai.
What's your favorite book?
My favorite book was a book called Boys in the Boat, and it was about a rowing team at the University of Washington in the U.S. that won the gold medal in the 1936 Olympics in Hitler's Germany. Very inspiring book.
The eighth question, are you an early bird or a night owl?
Early bird. I get up early. I get up pretty early, 6 o'clock. I'm in bed by 10 o'clock usually at night.
Pretty good routine there. The ninth question, what quote resonates with you most?
Well, there's one from Gandhi who said, be the change you want to see in the world. And that really resonates with me, for everyone to do your part to make the world a better place and to see the changes that you want.
The last question, it's about knowing what you know now. What advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
Probably to party less and to and to get involved in a worthwhile cause at a younger age. You know, that's probably what I would say. Yeah.
It turns out well. Turns out pretty good for you, I guess. I mean, you are now a very household name in the organic and non-GMO space, so you have nothing to worry about from my end, I guess.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you very much for joining me in this podcast. It was such a pleasure to have you on, for willing to share your experiences, your knowledge that you've gathered throughout the years. So for me, I find that valuable, and I'm sure a lot of people who will be listening to this conversation will find a lot of information in this podcast. So thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure was mine. I enjoyed it very much.